Your last appearance here, Dave, will be quite a hit.
Oh, really? Oh, I'm glad.
Well, you had so many interesting stories, funny stories to tell me.
I've forgotten what I told you. I probably wind up repeating myself. Oh, the business about my uncle. Yeah,
you're going up to Belmont, I think. You're going to Belmont. Was it, or Aqueduct?
Aqueduct, yeah, yeah.
And all those anecdotes. And, of course, the anecdote about the dead crab.
Yeah.
And trying to squeeze it into 2 minutes wasn't the easiest thing to do.
No, I could imagine.
But I had a couple of telephone calls, in fact, about it, and so it was. You tell a good story.
Oh, good. Thank you.
But you also talk in a very funny way in Hard Knocker's Luck on page 45, for example. I'm going to read to you, and you're going to have to explain this. I don't know if this is English. Well, maybe it's not 45.
I hope it's English. That's what I write in.
I'm not so sure. Here. Ed and Charlie, they're the doctors, right?
Yes.
They're talking out the track. Is it Del Mar?
No, I believe it's Santa Anita or Hollywood. I think it's Hollywood Park that early in the book, yeah.
Well, here, Charlie says, "I like the six horse. No chance," Ed contradicted him. "The one is a lock. I'm going to wheel him on top in exactas and back to two long shots, the four and the three." "The six horse is the winner," Charlie said. "I'm just going to bet him straight. Hell, he's 12-1, and he'll get off at no less than 10. The six won't finish the race." "Ed doesn't like money," Charlie observed. "The one has a lot of dog in him. He'll die in the last 16th. What does that mean?
Well, it means, you see, in the locked-in world of the racetrack, as in the, you know, every locked-in profession carries its own jargon. I've had a lot to do with the theater and with opera houses and so on, and people talk, it's the language of the profession. Lawyers, as we all know, speak an incomprehensible language. It's also the language of defense. We don't want outsiders to know what we're talking about. People who hang around racehorses develop a lot of terminology that makes sense to people who know about betting on racehorses or training them or whatever that mean nothing to the outside world. My mother had a terrible time reading my first book. She's my biggest fan. She was never able to get through it because it's... So in the second book, I tried to cut that racetrack terminology down so that outsiders would understand it. Wherever possible, I try to explain it, you know.
Maybe you ought to have a glossary in the back.
Yes, I should probably. You know, maybe like Tolstoy list the characters and what they do. It's not really all that complicated, I don't think. Probably within the context of the book, whenever a crucial conversation like that occurs, it's easily enough understood. But there is a fun... I created that little scene of dialogue just so that people would know how people actually do talk at racetracks.
Well, now, in The Hard Knocker's Luck, this is your second book dealing with your characters. Not only does he solve crimes and hang out at the racetracks, he's also a magician. And this takes place at a racetrack, or much of it does, in much the same way that Tip on a Dead Crab does. So you're fast becoming the American version of Dick Francis, I guess. Huh?
Well, I would like to think so. I'm a great admirer of Dick Francis. I think he writes, I particularly liked his early books, which had more to do with the races than his more recent books, which are also excellent books. I would consider that a very flattering comparison. But I don't know. I really enjoy writing these books. I've written a lot of different things in my life, and I enjoy most of what I write. But these books, I sit down, and they just seem to pour out of me. It takes me between 3 to 4 months to write one, and I can't wait to get back. One of the things that's frustrating me in New York is that I'm sort of running around seeing editors and agents and so on, because this is the literary capital of America, and you have to come here to do that. But I can't wait to get back, and I'm going to work on a third one.
How did you come up with such an unlikely hero, Swifty Anderson?
Well, I didn't want to, you know, I don't think of myself as a genre writer, and I was surprised when my publisher, Viking, stuck me in that category. They are mysteries, but I think of them as novels. I don't make those distinctions. I'm much more interested in the world of the track and the people who live and die by it. There do happen to be mysteries in it, but I didn't want a detective. Everybody has a detective. I know a lot about magicians just simply because I did a couple of stories, one for Cosmopolitan magazine years ago about magicians, and several magicians became friends of mine. They're wonderful people, magicians, and they're very unusual people, and unlike most people in show business, they're very helpful to each other, very supportive of each other's work. And the close-up magicians, which is what Shifty Lou Anderson is, are real artists. They have to work just as hard as ballet dancers or opera singers. It's a real discipline to be able to work with your hands, make small objects disappear right in front of your eyes. The big, you know, the magicians who work with the big acts, you know, changing ladies into tigers and so on, that's show business and it's construction and mirrors. The real magic is the people who work with their hands, the prestidigitators, as they used to be called.
Viking is treating you okay, as I recall last time you were here, I guess it was 2 years ago or so. You were coming out of a feud with, wasn't it Dodmead?
Dodmead, right. Mm-hmm. Yes, that was very unfortunate. And I don't know whether I want to reopen that old wound. But,
no.
You know, it was really a case of censorship. I wasn't the only victim of it, but the publishing house was swallowed up by a larger corporation, and they didn't like certain words in the book. There are very few naughty words in my book, and I was really astonished at what they did. It was a form of censorship, and I couldn't let them do it.
Oh, and I think he remarked the last time you were here that it was basically probably the cleanest book you ever wrote. And indeed, even in The Hard Knocker's Luck, the sex, I think that you describe one sex scene as when Swifty is in bed with, what's her name?
With Allison.
Allison, and yes. All arms and legs and things like that. You know, which is not, which tells you what's going on without having to be X-rated.
Well, I think we've come out the other side of the taboo. You know, for so many years up until D.H. Lawrence and Lady Chatterley's Lover and Ulysses, James Joyce's great book, people just didn't write openly and honestly about sex using the right words and so on. I think we've come through that. We've had far too much of that. I think maybe it's time for everybody to get back in the closet for a while. And I think that if you write a love scene, that what's important in the scene is not the geographical mechanics of lovemaking, but the emotions and feelings that people are undergoing while they're doing it. And I've come through that. I've done a certain amount of, lot of realistic writing on the other side. But I've finally come at this late stage in my life to realizing that what's much more important is that we convey the emotions and the feelings rather than the geography of love.
Are you a regular at the track?
Yes, I would consider myself I'm not really a hard knocker. A hard knocker, you know, is one of those racetrack definitions. It applies to a racehorse who tries very, very hard but doesn't have a lot of talent. And in the human sense, it applies to people who go to the track every day and they're beating their brains out against the parimutuel machines. No, I'm not like that, thank goodness, but I love the track. I go on an average of a couple of times a week. At Del Mar, which is my favorite racetrack in the world, I spend the entire 7 weeks down there, and I have what I consider the perfect life. I write in the morning, get about an hour of beach, and then go to the races in the afternoon. It's Hemingway's. He did that for one summer. Not that I'm comparing myself to Hemingway, but it is an ideal way to live, in my opinion.
Well, I hope you're not betting all the profits you're making on Swifty Anderson.
No, you know, I'm a very small bettor. I mean, if I make a $20 bet, that's a gigantic bet for me, and if I lose $100 in a day, I have to go and lie down with an ice bag on my head. But I don't bet away from the track, and I think, you know, betting at the races, you're betting against the other people who are there. You're not betting against the casino, and I think my chances are pretty good, so I don't lose at the races. I don't win much either, but I don't lose.
Are you still doing the letter from Italy column for the New Yorker?
Yes, I am, Don. I generally go to Italy twice a year, usually in the spring and for a shorter trip in the fall or winter, and try to do two or three pieces a year for the New Yorker, a magazine I've been associated with since 1956, a very great magazine with a very great editor. And I would never give that up. As long as they want me, I'll do it. And, of course, it gets me back to Italy, a country I love.
You were the fiction editor there one time, weren't you?
No, I was one of the fiction editors. Mm-hmm. I was the lowest person on the totem pole. There were seven of us. I started there in 1956 as really a glorified reader. Then as I found authors, and I picked up a few authors of my own. But, you know, after 4 years of doing that, I thought, if I have to read one more short story today, I'm going to kill myself. I used to read between 60 and 80 short stories a day. It was wonderful work, but primarily I'm a writer, and that's what I like to do. So I passed over to the writing side in 1961, and that's where I've been ever since.
Well, maybe you can clarify what a staff writer for The New Yorker is, because I was talking to a young staff writer, he says he's a staff writer in The New Yorker, named Alec Wilkinson.
I don't know him, but there are quite a few of us.
Yeah, well, Alec has written two books. One is called Moonshine, and then he wrote another one called Midnights a couple of years ago. He's quite a nice writer, and the latest book came out of research that he did for a New Yorker profile. So he's a staff writer for The New Yorker, but he's not sure what that means exactly. He says it doesn't seem to matter whether he goes into the office or not, although he works at a desk there because it's quiet. But he says when he went in Nobody told him where the pencils were or the bathroom or anything. He just came in, and so he was very vague. He wasn't sure how many staff writers they have or who they are, and so I was kind of wondering about that. If he's a staff writer, aren't you supposed to be on staff? And if you're a staff writer, you spend half the time in Italy and half the time in California? I mean, how does this work exactly?
Well, the New Yorker doesn't care where you are. All they care about is that you write for them. The New Yorker doesn't even care if you don't do a piece for a year or two. I don't know how many staff writers there are. I haven't met all of them. We're not on salary. All we do is we have a contract with the magazine, which is in essence a first reading agreement. We're perfectly free to sell pieces elsewhere as well as work for the New Yorker. We're perfectly free to write books, and many of us do. We can come into the office or not as we choose. The best work that writers do is done when they are given the freedom to do it. And the magazine is a very great magazine because it has given writers that freedom to do it. And if people ask me about magazines, I say, as far as I'm concerned, there's only one magazine. The other magazines are all highly commercial, over-edited. The pieces are never long enough, they don't go in depth. You know, we live in a fast-moving world where everything is on the surface. The New Yorker's not on the surface. It's an enduring and important magazine.
Mm. Well, I was confused because at CBS we have staff writers. We have two kinds of writers. We have writers who are freelance. And in the Writers Guild, of course, there are two. The contract breaks them down as freelance writers and then staff writers. I'm a staff person here. We have 19, 20 staff writers here at WCBS. But they are our staff. I mean, you're not paid by the story or by the piece. You get a salary and you get fees and you get benefits, insurance, and this sort of thing. But it works entirely different at the New Yorker.
Well, we get benefits. I have health insurance, and I have a pension plan, and I have dental insurance, and there's some benefits. It's a peculiar organization, which is what makes it unusual and terrific. A staff writer just simply means that you have a contract with the magazine, and they want to have a first look at what you do. And then if they're not obligated to buy what you do or even to publish it. So it's a little bit like walking on a tightrope, but you have the advantage of being a freelancer without all of the risks.
You know, that's interesting. You mentioned that you have the benefits. So many writers, if they're not that many full-time writers who make a living solely from their writing, I guess there's a substantial amount, but not that many in terms of all the people who are writing today. But how do they manage their hospitalization and their retirement and this sort of thing?
I really don't know. I think that being a lot of writers wind up, you know, with the academic community at their backs. I think it's important. It's tough being a freelance writer. It's very, very tough. And I know very few, even Saul Bellow, you know, and Doctorow and John Irving, all highly successful and highly praised and very rich authors. You know, I noticed that they don't sever their academic contacts. I also notice that when I travel, I stay with friends or in inexpensive hotels, and my agents and editors are always at the Ritz. So there's a little more security in being with the forces of the establishment rather than being out there. But, you know, it's like the fable of Aesop's fable of the thin dog and the fat dog. You have more freedom as the thin dog, but you don't eat as well.
Have you ever taught?
No, I haven't, but I'd like to, and there's a prospect next year that I may teach a creative writing course at one of the University of California campuses, and I'm really looking forward to it. I think it's about time I did some of that. It will be a very practical course.
Would you consider going to Ohio to teach?
No, I don't think so. I like California.
You wouldn't consider going to Ohio, huh?
No.
All right, just thought I'd ask.
Or Iowa either.
Or Iowa. Iowa is the
Iowa Writers Workshop. Yes, I would. Actually, I'm being facetious in my answer. I think, but I live in California, and my wife works in California, and it would be difficult to do that. But
we're talking about a semester or two semesters. Something.
Yes, I'd consider it. I'd be very happy to do that.
Reason I asked, I just threw it out. This is not an offer or anything. I just threw it out. Is that I'm on the Ohio University Alumni Board of Directors, and we are attempting to start a permanent visiting writer program.
I think that's a great idea.
There is a creative writing program there now, but the funds have never allowed to bring in stars, to bring in good outside people on a temporary basis.
Like yes.
And there are a whole bunch of problems involved there. You have to, they're tied in with real estate and this sort of thing. You have to find a place for them to live. You can't just expect somebody to pack up and go to an out-of-the-way small town in the middle of nowhere and try to find a place to live and finance that and all that. So it all has to be tied in as a package. So I'm going to Athens tomorrow, in fact, to continue working on this thing.
Well, good for you. I think that's a terrific project. I think, you know, there's a lot of resistance, I think, on the part of some sectors of the academic community to bringing in people from the outside. There's an entrenched academic mafia that I'm very suspicious and hostile of, and who are hostile to people who've made their way in the outside world. And then there are a lot of people inside the academic community who also are very receptive to it. But I think that it's very important and valuable that students, particularly talented ones, should be in contact with people who have had to deal with the rough day-to-day world of dealing with editors, agents, and so on, and making a living as professional writers.
In fact, and working as I have the last number of years with the university, I've noticed that there are turf problems within the academic organization. Everybody is very anxious to protect his turf and not very happy if somebody comes out with something brilliant, somebody other than himself, of course.
Yes.
I mean, there is some academic pride for that given community, but there's a lot of rivalry within it. And obviously, if it's recommended that you bring in Saul Bellow to teach for a year, you know, in a way that casts a very long shadow to the people who are there already on the campus. So there are problems with regard to that.
Oh, I can imagine. They're understandable problems. I think I remember that when I had a play production of, I've also translated in my peculiar literary career, 16 plays by the Italian playwright Luigi Pirandello. And these plays get done quite a bit. We had a very, very good production, a professional production by the theater group in Los Angeles when it was then located on the UCLA campus. And Gordon Davidson, the producer, we offered to take in any number of people who wanted to come and audit from the UCLA Theater Arts Department, that they would be welcome and they would be able to follow a professional theatrical production from casting right down to the opening night. And only one kid came, and he told us that they had really discouraged it over at the Theater Arts Department. They were so jealous of their prerogatives, and they sat there, you know, with a multi-million dollar plant, sophisticated light boards and everything else, and we were struggling along in a haphazard theater that we could only get into at occasional times. But we had the professionals. We had professional working actors, professional director, doing the kind of productions that every young drama student should be able to assist of a great playwright. But it was amazing the opposition we got. It was an eye-opener.
Yeah. Also, there's another problem, too. This is not true of every campus, but it's true with some, including my own. I think there's been a swing away from the humanities and toward more technologically oriented courses. I noticed they have, for example, because they got a $250,000 windfall from some outfit in Texas, a gas rig on the university golf course, and they're pumping for their own natural gas or something. I just think that $250,000, I guess having a gas well is all right, but I can think of a lot of things that I would like to do with $250,000 on the campus, and that would be to shore up the English department. I wasn't even an English major. I was a communications guy, but I could just have this feeling that too many campuses are going out striking for technology, and I just hope that we don't abandon our humanities.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. You know, it's all very well, you know, to become a masterful computer person, but you've got to know what you have to master the language and learn how to think in a creative and constructive way before the computer isn't going to do it for you. Whenever I'm asked whether I've invested in a word processor, I say no, not because it wouldn't be useful, but because I really don't need it. What you need to do, what you must be able to do, is to write well. The computer comes afterwards. It isn't going to solve your problems for you.
No, but it's going to make life a lot easier.
Well, not to me, but then I'm middle-aged and I don't need the computer.
Well, I'm middle-aged I've had a computer since April and I use it every day, and it doesn't make you write better, that's true, but it makes you want to write more.
Yes.
Because it's so efficient and you can juggle things around and store things and find
things. But if you were as mechanically inept as I am, Don, it would take me about a year and a half to master the word the computer. I would, having written the occasional screenplay, from my point of view, the next screenplay assignment I get, I will certainly master the word processor and learn how to do it, because I did one last spring. I wrote a long treatment, and it would have saved me 2 weeks of time. But for novels and short stories, I feel that I like to work the way I work, and it's everybody develops his own work pattern. And
I can't type anymore. I sit at a typewriter, and
I never could type. I'm a two-finger smasher.
Are you really?
Yeah.
I am, too.
I only got to electric typewriters about 5 years ago.
Well, William Murray, my last question to you. Have you been doing any singing lately?
No, not much singing. Occasionally in the bathroom I'll cut loose. I'm one of the great, bathroom tenors of my time, but that's about what I've been doing with my voice recently. I think I sound better in there to myself than I'm sure I sound to anybody else.
Well, I hope that we can expect to have Swifty Anderson back with us before too long, up to his old tricks.
Yes, well, I'm already at work on another one, and it has an operatic background. I can't wait to get back to it.
William Murray, thank you very much.
Thank you, Don.